The parcelization test works in areas like Washington County. In fact, you know, that will bring marginal land to some of the areas west of the Cascades. What you find, and I should point this out, is that as far as the poor lands test, there's very little in Western Oregon. Because of the site class, almost all is quite good forestry land. And most of the cubic foot volume of wood that is produced is over, you find the site class goes over 100, and our cutoff point in at the present time is 85.
Representative Traern,
why did you pick that 85 figure in that it is very low if you look at some very poor forest land in southwest Oregon?
I'm glad you brought that up, because that's another one that I'd like to have you take a very good look at. We brought in 50 cubic feet because we were particularly concerned about particularly eastern Oregon, because in eastern Oregon, you know, the commercial timber companies are making a tremendous battle to try and save land from wilderness area that only produces 20 cubic feet. And so I think that probably that 50 cubic feet, it will have no impact as near as we can determine in western Oregon. But in eastern Oregon, we better look and possibly change that back to the 50 that we had in the bill originally.
You mean 20.
I had 50 originally.
The 50 cubic feet per acre per year of growth in wood.
Mr. Chairman, did you look at forest land site classes at all rather than going by cubic feet per acre?
We did. We thought it was more precise to simply state the cubic feet. As I understand, the 50 is the, what is it, site class 5, is it? I'm not too clear on, since I'm not a forester, the break between the two, but the 50 is one break, and the 85 is the next one above that for site classification.
So if we were to say site class 4 or 5 land, as an example, where we broke
as that, an example, you would be
it
correct.
It would be similar in
it
your
would be, yes, it would be the
of
same.
What these are.
Right.
Thank you.
I think at this point it might be well, because one of the criticisms that we've had of the bill was that it wasn't going to bring any land in. And so I want to take you to two counties and point out what marginal lands might do for them if the county decides to go for it. And I'm going to take Washington County from western Oregon and Wasco County from eastern Oregon and point out what lands might be declared marginal because of the passage of this bill. Unfortunately, since the bill has been changed, I can't give you figures that are identical for what is in the bill today, because we went out and did certain tests within individual areas, but we were using somewhat different criteria than what ended up in the bill. But I think they come close enough that if I give you an indication, you'll know the direction that we're going. You may know that in Washington County, there's been a tremendous battle over there over certain lands that they were trying to take exceptions over. And so this is the particular area that we looked at to see if some of those lands that they've had the big battle over might be included as marginal lands. And we concluded, and in fact, we went through six individual sites, that is, maps that are of Washington County, to determine, using the criteria of a 50% average, in other words, the same 50% that we have in the bill that has to be parcelized. And this is all on the basis of parcelization, you realize. It's not on soil quality. And where the parcelization was 20 acres or less. And to boil the six sites down that were examined, they found that there was 1,319 acres of land that would qualify as marginal land, if it all were put into marginal land, that would qualify based on the parcelization in Washington County due to the parcelization that was in this particular area. Washington County, Clackamas County are counties that obviously have more than other counties. We think there would be some in almost all of western Oregon, and certainly in eastern Oregon counties, that would qualify. This is land we think is on the fringes of the EFU zone, and probably this is the kind of land we would be giving up by applying marginal land. Wasco County is a different... Yes, question?
Excuse me. I just want to get a little bit better perspective on that figure. 1,300 acres would qualify in all of Washington County?
No.
Or just the little area that you looked at?
The areas that we looked at. You realize, of course, that the areas we looked at were the ones that were most likely to have it.
Okay.
So you're not going to find this proportional at all over the entire county.
Could you give me any kind of an estimate? You obviously looked at the controversial areas where there is some parcelization
yes.
already existing. Can you give me any kind of an estimate as to how many total acres were looked at to come up with that figure?
We can't, unfortunately, and I we simply didn't run our test right to give you what proportion this would be out of total acreage, even in the areas that we looked at.
Okay.
So that I don't have that.
That's fine. Thank you.
Okay, now in Wasco County, now this is an eastern Oregon county in which the poor land test becomes the predominant one, but not completely. And this is an area, if any of you are familiar, the area along 7 Mile Hill Road in Wasco County. The area is comprised of 17,431 acres, 10,208 acres of which are in the FF40 zone, and 7,223 of which are in the FF20. Now, these are farm forest, and one of them has a 40-acre lot size, and the one has a 10-acre zone lot size. And going through, and rather than to summarize what they said, they really all of the area of the area here would be a marginal as far as the site class, or the, in other words, for either the agriculture, they're class 7 through 8 primarily. So it's very poor soil. Now, there was one of the areas that they looked at that was somewhat better soil classes than the other. That is, there was more class 3 in this, but it was in the area that was right adjacent to the farm areas. And in this, they had 1,698 acres composed predominantly of class 3 soils, the remaining of class 6 and 7. The area is situated on the fringe of commercial land to the west and south. The area is highly parcelized. 81% of the ownerships are less than 20 acres. 86% are less than 30 acres. And there are a few cherry orchards in there, it says, however, and they only produce 2 to 3 tons of acre, 2 to 3 tons of cherries per year. In other words, foresight 6, in other words, less than 50 cubic feet per year. And so the conclusion was that in this area, too, there was... the area would qualify for marginal lands. Now, we said 17,431 acres total in the area that was looked at, and most of that apparently would qualify as marginal land. So you see that it really can be significant in eastern Oregon where there is land. We've done a little checking on it, but I'm not going to try and give you any figures for southern Oregon. We think that Jackson County, for instance, has quite a little bit, and you'd find it almost everywhere. But and it goes on, the same test was checked out to see if the county agent thought that there were commercial farms within that would not qualify because of the $20,000 test. And they said, well, there might be one or two, but they didn't think there was very much. So we really haven't explored that completely, but that gives you a picture of what it is that we're talking about for the application of marginal land, both in eastern and western Oregon.
Mr. Chairman.
Parkinson.
Wasco County again, then you said that there would be area there that would qualify because of the income test?
I said that would qualify. This one particular area that I singled out had quite a little marginal land for parcelization. The income test thought did not really apply anywhere in this entire 17,000 acres that they looked at. In other words, there might be one or two that, you know, if you looked at it specifically, you might find a little area that didn't qualify, but most of it would qualify for all the tests that we have. Okay.
And then in Washington County, there again it would qualify because of the parcel test.
Parcelization only, right.
And did you find any area where the income test would be a qualifier?
Well, I'm sure that you would find some, I'm sure that if you looked in any specific area, you might find that if, depending on where you exactly do your lines, you could get folks in there that were commercial operators making your $20,000 and therefore would have to not be included in your test area. The next point that I would go to now is the lot of record provision that has already been referred to, and I don't know how much additional detail you might want on that, but it's significant, I think, that there are two lots of record in this bill, and I think I want to be sure that you understand that there are two separate lots of record, one of them dealing with the marginal land, and one of them dealing in the EFU land. You understand that in the marginal land, the lot of record is really very open-ended in that it allows almost anything that comes through the time frame that was set down, January 1st, 1948 and January 1st, 1978, regardless of size. You see, that's the lot of record for the marginal land.
Hector, on the marginal land, did you still retain the contiguous blood relative?
Yes, both of them retain the contiguous. If you have three lots all owned in the same ownership or your family ownership, you only get one house.
Why is that?
Well, I suppose that I shouldn't call that the Jim Allison situation, but anyway, there are cases where people have deliberately cut up their parcels into units that they hope they could subdivide on and retain them in the same ownership. And we think that is unfair if they just simply tried to figure out ahead of time what was going to happen and did that.
Mr. Chairman? Mr. McPherson, I have an employee that bought a 15-acre parcel of, I imagine it'd be marginal land, I'm not sure. Anyway, he built a house, overextended himself, but yet the next 15-acre parcel became available, and he bought it on contract too. Now he's in danger of losing his home, but he can't sell off the second lot. Did you run into that much of that?
I can't say that we really looked at that specific problem. I think whenever you draw a line, you'll have people that don't quite meet it. And if it's a marginal land area, if he doesn't have the 20 acres, why, he's just like anyone else that doesn't have 20 acres in that particular kind of a zone.
Thank you.
Now, the lot of record in the EFU land, and if I could diverge enough to point out that this does not fit the general philosophy of Ag for Oregon, because we think there should be fewer homes built in the genuine EFU land that we have. But we have it. There's a lot of controversy over it, and we're willing to give up the provision that we have here, which says that if you have a 2-acre or less parcel in an exclusive farm use zone, then the only test you have to meet to build on that particular parcel, even though, in other words, it can be Class 1, 2, or 3, which we have now forbidden as for general home building, you may build a house on it. This is, I think, opens it up a crack. It allows some development out there, and I think if I were to rationalize it from the general viewpoint of Ag for Oregon, I would say that we think that the majority of the places where this would be used would be infilling in already existing subdivisions that were where you put on a broad EFU classification. You'd have infilling of old subdivisions, and where this happens, it has certainly less impact on the surrounding farms. Are there any questions on lots of record?
What are the dates on that?
The dates are the same on that, are January 1st, 1948 to January 1st, 1978. If you want to turn to the summary sheet, on page 2 of the summary sheet that we gave you, you can see at the bottom of that page, you may want to read that over, and if you come up with any questions on that, it tells you what provisions are in the lot of record, two sections. Now I want to go to the new criteria for farm and non-farm dwellings in an EFU zone. We've shifted gears now. We're not talking about marginal land. We're talking about EFU zones. The problem that Ag for Oregon saw was the incursion of a number of non-farm dwellings in there that were being granted by the counties, even though there were sufficient criteria already in the statutes. It was vague enough that they were being allowed, and the only way to turn these around was simply to try and challenge in court, and almost all of those that went on up to LUBRA or some higher court were turned down. We want to make criteria that is very plain and understandable, and so we've drawn the new criteria for both non-farm and farm dwellings in a way that I think anyone can interpret them much more easily. Now, I don't believe I'll go through the changes in the tests that we have for a non-farm dwelling. That on the top of page 3 of the summary, you'll see what those tests are. We have now only a non-interference and a general unsuitability test for those non-farm dwellings that are allowed in the EFU zone. But the big change is that we say no non-farm dwellings on Class 1, 2, and 3 soil. In other words, 4, 5, 6, 7, and 8, the other end of the spectrum, yes, we still have the criteria. You can go in and get them approved just as you always have, except we've got a slight change in the criteria themselves. So no new non-farm dwellings anywhere in the state on Class 1, 2, or 3 soil, except, and the exception, of course, is only the lot of record thing that I've already discussed with you.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Trader.
Given one of these instances that you're addressing in the non-farm dwellings, and recognizing that a total parcel is probably not all the same soil class, would it be possible to build on one portion of the parcel and not on another because part of it may be class 3 and part of it class 4 soils?
I think we say predominantly, and I suppose that means 50% of it has to be poor. 51% has to be poor.
Thank you.
Now, it gets complicated again when we start talking about the new tests for farm dwellings, because here again, if you're going to cut off the non-farm dwellings that people have been qualifying for quite easily, you have to be sure that people don't come and simply ask for farm dwellings and get them approved. We start off in a fashion that's very similar to what we've had. We've said that any county that has a minimum lot size, you can get a farm dwelling simply by owning that size of parcel. So there really isn't any change in the minimum lot size for if you're in a county that has a minimum lot size, we simply assume that there is permitted outright. Now, if you're in a county that has no minimum lot size, or if you're in a county that has a minimum lot size, but you want to build a house on something less than the minimum lot size for that county, then we get into another series of complications here that I think I'll refer you back to the bill itself on page 6 and 7. What I've already discussed on page 6 is the outright use, which you see the new wording there, which does that.
What, 9?
On 9:14 through 17 is the outright use that allows farm dwellings as part of a farmer unit not smaller than the minimum lot size for the farm zone, with a minimum lot size approved under, in other words, that the LCD has already approved. Page 7, we get to the changes on what happens if you're in one of these other counties that does not have a minimum lot size, or the parcel you're considering is smaller than that particular, than is it would be permitted otherwise. Now, the big new change, and you'll see that repeated in here, there's never been a provision in Oregon law to permit a farm dwelling in conjunction with a farm with a woodlot for forestry purposes. So we try to bring them in. We think that that's appropriate even in the EFU zone, which is primarily not designed for forestry. So we say that if you're in conjunction with a farm use, the propagation or harvesting of a forest product on a lot or parcel that is managed as part of a farm unit or woodlot, or farm unit or woodlot. Now, A, consists of 20 acres or more. If you fall below 20 acres, you have to go through the rest of the test. Is not smaller than the average farm or woodlot in the county, producing at least $2,500 in annual gross income from the crops, livestock, or forest products to be raised on the farm or woodlot. Now, what this is saying, I have here a census data, and I'm not going to take time because the time is getting away from me, to show you the kind of data that's there, but there's data there to show you what the average lot size is in every county in the state for those farms that produce $2,500 in gross income. Now, $2,500 is a very small figure, but you find it doesn't make that much difference if you're dealing with average lot sizes. So that information is available. We find out if the person wants to grow wheat and it says that the average lot size is 90 acres and he comes in with 20 acres, says, I'm going to grow wheat. You say, well, you're not qualified, and you have to go, unless you go to the bottom half of this test. And the bottom half of this test is that you've got to show that you can do whatever it is you want to do. What has happened out there in the past is simply that people come in, and they're getting knowledgeable in this thing. They hire a smart person to write up a farm plan. And the farm plan will say, I'm going to grow strawberries, I'm going to grow rabbits, I'm going to do this, I'm going to do that. When you do this, then you get, yes, it qualifies under the present termination of the law, so that these are granted. Now, what we say is, okay, if you're in this one of these categories that's it's smaller than the average for what it is you're proposing to do, you've got to prove yourself first. You've got to go out and produce whatever it is you want to produce before we're going to let you build a house. So for 2 years, you've got to make $10,000 in gross income. Now, $10,000 in gross income is just sales now. So it isn't a big figure. but you've got to prove your position. Now, the other thing, since the income test obviously isn't going to work if you're going to plant an orchard, for instance, because it takes longer than that to grow your trees. So we say that you don't have to actually grow the trees and produce the $10,000 worth of income, but then you've got to grow, you've got to plant the trees that would, they're perennial, and this in this case trees would be the perennial, that would, at maturity, give you the $10,000 gross. And these, in other words, the data is here in the census data to check up on these things so that it isn't too difficult to prove. But where you don't have anything else to go on, you say, okay, you don't get your house now. Go out and prove yourself, live somewhere else for that period of time, and then you come in and we'll let you build your house.
Mr. Chairman?
Mr.
McPherson, have you sort of appraised the costs of such, to doing such, so that people might not still just hire someone and do that for a couple of years, or plant the trees and still be able to make a tremendous amount of money on the development of this land and go back and not do that after they've had those building, a home built there?
Well, I think you can't plug every crack, and I think that is a possibility, that even where we've said you've got to go out and plant them. Remember, it's quite an expensive thing to go out and plant an orchard or something that's a perennial, and we think that'll be enough of a deterrent. If that gets to be too big a problem, we'll be back to Representative Priestley in a couple of years and ask you to plug that loophole. But we don't really see that now would be enough of a problem to try and write additional law to. There simply is not the capability on the county level to go out and police this thing beyond what we're doing. We think we can do it that much and probably be fairly safe, however.
Thank you.
That is really the heart and the meat of the bill, but I should point out the other things we've already had mentioned that we have in the bill. Subdivisions are prohibited on page 3 of that summary. We talk about minor partitioning, and I think I would look at the minor partitioning section of this bill as being primarily a tool for consumer protection. Almost all the counties in the state, as I understand, there are 5 counties that now don't have a minor partitioning ordinance, Tillamook County and I think 4 in eastern Oregon. And what happens now is that a person can cut up his land in those areas and no one knows the difference. He goes ahead and sells them, and then the guy comes in and says, well, I want to build a house. Well, sorry, you can't build a house. So we think it's important to have a minor partitioning ordinance out there that at least, if nothing else, will make it known that this land is being cut up, and that the person who comes in then to build the house, well, at least he's been forewarned. There are a couple of miscellaneous provisions in the bill that are not terribly significant, but I should call your attention to. There's one that awards attorney's fees to a prevailing party in any action to remove an illegal structure. We've had on the, it's currently in the law that an individual as well as a county can contest these things. Now we say that the prevailing party should get attorney's fees, and we hope maybe this would do a little bit toward getting better enforcement of such things as illegal dwellings in the farm use zone. The last thing we have is a life estate provision, which is primarily educational. We say that if a retiring farmer wants to live on his land after, as he retires and wants to sell his farm, he's entitled to live there as a non-farm dwelling. He really can do that now, but this is an educational tool that let him know that this is something that he might want to consider when he sells off his farm, is to simply stay there after he sells the land. Now, I should summarize for you the things that I think should be changed in the bill that came out of the bill the way you have it in front of you. And those 3 things are ones that I've already touched on first. The first 3 were ones that I've already touched on, and that is the rule that went down to 100 acres from 320 acres in the marginal land. I think that's inappropriate, and I think that we can justify that, and we'd be glad to do some more work justifying it if I haven't done it here today. I think we need to take another really good look at the forest classification of 85 feet and put it back to the 50 feet, because I think it has more impact on eastern Oregon than it should have when you go down to that low. And the third one, I'm not sure that I pointed it out, is the term significant contribution. When we're talking about our $20,000, we don't say that you can't have any land that might be marginal if you're in a farm that is producing 20,000. And the problem we get into if we put in this significant contribution language that is in the bill at the present time, we have land, particularly I would say in the grazing areas, where you have a rather a poor section of land, and that land, the fellow goes in and he grazes it maybe for only 60 days or so in the spring, and then at the rest of the year it's, you know, dries up, there's nothing there. And you might say that's marginal land because it's poor quality, but that may be a significant part, or it may not be. It may be, but it's a part of his ongoing livestock operation. And if he's making $20,000 or more, we think he ought to probably have that spring grazing off of that land rather than to say that that land can be cut up and put more houses in there, which may in turn bring people and the dog problem and all the other problems that you might get onto in a livestock type of operation. So those are the three things. And those things, I might emphasize again, came into the bill at the last minute. We had no opportunity to refute them or to work with the committee on those three changes that were made at the very last minute. Now there's another...
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
Your tie, Representative Priestley.
What's that?
No.
Both asked the same time.
Asked Representative Priestley
first.
Okay. Mr. McPherson, the significant contribution language, you prefer that to not be there? What do you
I prefer want? That should not be there. We ought to, if we're going to do it, let's take out the word significant and just say contribution, because then you prove that it has any contribution. I can see a number of court tests coming on if you leave that significant word in there, because then you get to arguing, well, is this significant or isn't it? And the guy says, well, it isn't, and then you've got to go in and prove that it either is or isn't, and it's virtually impossible to do.
In other words, contribution, should even that be there? Should it be required that it produce 20,000 just pure and
well,
simple?
Well, there is land that may be part of a farm operation where the land is, where the fellow doesn't make any use of it at all. And we know of some of that in southern Oregon where it really doesn't make any contribution. And I'm willing to concede that land that doesn't make any contribution could be a part of this.
All right. Thank you.
Representative Bradbury.
Same question. Already been answered.
Right. Yeah. Thank you very much. Okay. Now, one of the things that we lost in the bill, and I think there's been new information that's come up, and I should call it to your attention again. We had took golf courses as a conditional use out of the EFU zone. The big hassle, the big controversy was in the OSU golf course. But a few of those of you who read the Oregonian, we have had a new case of a golf course to go in on class the very best soil on Sauvies Island. Multnomah County now has a proposal to take the land out of the farm use that it's in and put it into a major golf course. And we'd like to have you take another look at golf courses in EFU zone. It doesn't mean that we're going to have them there are no more golf courses. You simply, by taking them out, means they have to go through a different process to get a zone change. If you make a conditional use, it's very easy to make that kind of and mention them in the law as being a permitted conditional use. We think we ought to take another look at golf courses. Another one that we lost in the battle on the Senate side was the farm panel. We had proposed that when you talked about when it came to administering the changes in an EFU area, we thought a farm panel was an appropriate way to go. We have the language for that. If you're interested in it, we understand that maybe it was proposed over here. If you want it, why? We would certainly agree that it should go back in. There's one issue that I don't ask you to put back in because you've already considered it. The one thing that we considered very important was the standing issue in an EFU zone. You've looked at it, you've said that it's too hot to handle, and we accept that. But if you did have a change of heart on that one, we would be very happy to have that one back as well. But that primarily are the changes that I would ask you at this time to seriously consider. Well, to summarize everything that I've said, I think we need marginal land because it has certain benefits for part-time farmers and for rural residents. We give them an area to go that's not in the EFU zone, and therefore improves the entire picture in the EFU zone and gives people a greater option. One thing that I don't think has been pointed out either is that by shifting land that is now zoned EFU to marginal, we take away the tax provisions that are more generous in the EFU zone than they are in the unzoned land. So you probably have increased the revenue that the county will bring in in their areas that are zoned marginal. They now have to meet the income tests that are in unzoned land rather than the EFU tests.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Traer.
I'm sure he misspoke himself, but it doesn't really increase the revenue. It just shifts the load. The same amount of dollars you've got
okay.
to pay in either case.
Well, you'll have individuals paying more dollars because if they do not meet that, they'll be paying on the full rather than farm use assessment they'll be paying. So
that's
I
true, but others will be paying less. The same amount of money will come into the county.
Right. You're being very technical, and I appreciate that. Okay, more. I think that the other big advantage is simply that we are getting a more precise measure for the farm and the non-farm homes that go into a farm zone, and this will certainly have some benefits in from preventing litigation and make it easier to administer. Now, the last thing I'm going to leave you with is simply the idea that we need a lot more land, particularly in Western Oregon, for non-farm, for the part-time farmer. I want to point out that we already have taken exceptions on 200,000 acres in Western Oregon, in exceptions areas, and about 800,000 acres statewide that is in rural residential, which allows people to go into. So we've got a lot of land out there. But the one that most people don't realize, we also have throughout Western Oregon, and I'm not as clear